Welcome to Inspired, a production of Interfaith Voices. This week, we take a closer look at what happens when a deeply held belief that one must ease suffering on the border clashes with the government. For Scott Warren, that clash led to his arrest and two federal trials. In November of 2019, he was acquitted and found not guilty. His defense team's strategy broke new ground.
It's really the first opinion we've seen from a federal court that was willing to recognize a religious liberty defense in a criminal prosecution like this.
Catherine Frankie is a law professor and the faculty director of the Law, Rights, and Religion Project at Columbia University. She pays close attention to how religious liberty claims are being used.
We've recently issued a very comprehensive report called Whose Faith Matters, that documents, really from before the founding of the United States up until the present, the many contexts where progressive social activists have turned to religious liberty as part of their advocacy strategies.
You filed a brief in support of Scott Warren's defense. Could you talk a little bit about what drew you to that particular case and why you felt it was important to raise the issues that you did?
Well, the way that we protect religious liberty in this country, whether it's through federal law like the Religious Freedom Restoration Act or the First Amendment's protections for religious liberty, is that we have to do so in a way that's neutral. And that means we can't just protect the rights of some believers and not protect the rights of others. We can't favor some religious traditions over others. And what I've seen with this administration is that they are more than willing to aggressively defend the rights of evangelical Christians. But when it comes to Muslims or other types of faith-based actors, particularly when they're acting in ways to protest federal government policy as an article of their faith, not only is the Justice Department not coming to the rescue to protect their religious liberty rights, but they're actually prosecuting them for federal crimes. And so it's that failure to be neutral when it comes to faith traditions that has drawn me to look at contexts where progressive people of faith are using religious liberty as a way to defend their own protest of the actions of this government. And Scott Warren's case was an excellent example of that.
Were you heartened by the decision of the court?
I was absolutely heartened. It's really the first opinion we've seen from a federal court that was willing to recognize a religious liberty defense in a criminal prosecution like this. The judge followed the reasoning that we gave him in the amicus brief, the friend of the court brief that I wrote on behalf of law professors who are experts in this area. And the facts were overwhelming in Scott's favor. The Justice Department prosecutors behaved very badly in this lawsuit, in this prosecution. So I felt like it was an appropriate chastising of the bias of the Trump administration's Justice Department when it comes to both immigration law and the rights of immigrants and activists working with immigrants, but also in protecting religious liberty.
Can you speak to that? What specifically are you describing when you talk about the prosecutorial bad acts?
Well, when the Justice Department prosecutors were deposing, that is interviewing before trial, Scott, to find out really what were the nature of his religious beliefs that motivated him to put water and food and clothing in the desert for people who would have died, really would have died without them, they mocked him. They made fun of the things that he believed so sincerely in, of his deep commitment to human life and the sacredness of human life. So that's just one example. They've done it in other cases as well with priests and nuns who were protesting nuclear weapons and were prosecuted by the federal government. They also mocked them as not being sincere in their religious beliefs. And it was just shocking to see that in both these cases.
Could you speak to how the Trump administration has viewed those types of acts and where you see some of the major challenges?
Well, the work that No More Deaths and Scott Warren, along with a number of other activists, he's not the only one who's been prosecuted by the federal government, I would note, but the work that they're doing is merely carrying on a long tradition of people of faith to show up for people fleeing violence in Central America. There were a number of priests and nuns and other people of faith who were prosecuted in the 1980s for violating federal, what we call harboring laws. They were all convicted or took pleas. The difference between the 1980s and now is that our religious liberty laws are much stronger, much stronger. They're getting protections now that the activists, nuns, and priests did not get in the 80s because the laws changed, really as a result of the advocacy of the religious right wing.
What happens when you have it's the religious liberty rights of a conservative Christian and the religious liberty rights of a spiritual progressive?
It's interesting to note that the most important Supreme Court cases around religious liberty that evolved in the 60s, 70s, and 80s were from minority religious traditions. And so the court recognized that they had to protect all religious faith traditions, not just those that we're more familiar with. But what's troubling about the very broad and I think at times radical way in which the religious right has been pushing a theory of religious liberty, and it's increasingly embraced by the Supreme Court, is that in the end, it's so broad, it's actually bad for religious liberty itself, because the religious liberty rights of minority faith traditions will come into conflict with the religious liberty rights of majority-based traditions. Let me give you another example. You can imagine a situation where you have a conservative Christian employer who does not support their gay employees getting married. But the gay employees may themselves have a faith-based justification for getting married. They too are members of a religious congregation for whom marriage is a sacrament. And indeed, living together or engaging in sexual relations outside of marriage may violate their religious beliefs. So the employer will fire them if they get married as an expression of their religious beliefs. And that employee will feel pressure not to marry, even though their faith tells them they should, because they might lose their job if they do marry. So in those contexts, you have faith on both sides. And how should the courts deal with that kind of conflict, particularly with an institution that in so many places is sacred, something like marriage?
These issues that you're raising are ones that come before the Supreme Court. And with the nomination of Amy Coney Barrett, a number of questions have been raised about her views on religious liberty. What is your analysis?
We've already seen a shift in the Supreme Court with the appointment of more conservative justices over the last several years around the role of religious liberty in the landscape or the ecology of all the other rights that are protected under the Constitution. So when religious liberty rights are used as a way to get an exemption from having to recognize same-sex marriages, or to get an exemption from having to recognize the rights of transgender people, or as a way to not have to recognize Roe versus Wade and rights to reproductive justice or liberty, what some of these advocates are arguing is that religious liberty rights should always win. And they now have on the court three or four solid votes for that position, that all other rights have to yield in the face of the exercise of religious liberty rights. There is nothing in the Constitution that says that the First Amendment's free exercise rights are paramount to every other right in the Constitution. What the court has for decades and decades done is balance thoughtfully how we live in a pluralistic society where rights often come into conflict. Some will get prominence and others will yield, and in another day, those that yield would gain prominence in a different case. So what I worry about with the kinds of appointments that we're seeing to the court now is that they're embracing a view of the Constitution that sees some rights as much more fundamental than other rights. And that just is really violates the very idea of a rights-based constitution and the kind of pluralism that I think we celebrate in this country. Even though I believe very deeply that if the federal government is going to aggressively protect the rights of evangelical Christians on the right, they must also protect the religious liberty rights of people like Scott Warren and the No More Deaths activists. In any event, I feel like religious liberty-based exemptions from law should be protected in very narrow circumstances, because I worry about a world in which anybody can raise their hand and say, I don't have to comply with this law because I have a faith-based objection to it. What that threatens to do is undermine core democratic principles. Normally, when a law is passed that you don't agree with, it's because you were on the losing side of a majoritarian process. There were more votes for the other position. And what should you do? Elect different people, right? Go back through the democratic process and get the law changed. But if what we do instead is say, all right, that law exists, but I don't have to respect it. I'm not bound by it because it conflicts with my religion. What we're doing is we're saying the religious law is paramount to secular, democratically made law. And the more and more and more that we expand religious exemptions, what we're doing is undermining democracy. And that is very worrisome to me.
That was Catherine Franke. She's the James L. Jour Professor of Law at Columbia Law School, where she also directs the Center for Gender and Sexuality Law. She's among the nation's leading scholars writing on law, religion, and rights. A special thanks to Sacred Steps, a collaborative reporting project between KALW San Francisco and the University of Southern California's Center for Religion and Civic Culture. And that team includes executive producer Judy Silber, editor Cheryl Duvall, and of course, Jude Joffe Block. Sound design credits to Tarek Fauda with additional audio support from Dario Miranda. And a special thanks to Judy Kampner and Paul Ingram. Music in this episode from Blue Dot Sessions and MC Yogi. This week's episode of Inspired was produced by Kevin McCarthy. I'm your host, Umbreen Khan, and if you missed any portion of the show, subscribe to the podcast. Just search Interfaith Voices wherever you listen, and you can catch every episode and some extras. For details on No More Death and the reports mentioned in this broadcast, visit the show notes at interfaithradio.org. Where you can also check out the archives, subscribe to our newsletter, and, of course, learn more about us. Wherever you are, we hope you stay safe and connected. See you next week.